Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2003, is with the late Professor Richard G. Stern and Professor Richard A. Stryer. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm delighted to be here today with my good friend Dick Stern in sunny Chicago to talk about the life and times and work of Dick Stern and associated memories and thoughts. So we have a question to start off with, so we're just going to get going. So here's the question to start off with. Dick, you've been at the University of Chicago 30-odd years.
40-odd.
40-odd years. your basically whole adult life as a writer, a thinker. The question I thought we might start off with is, what difference has it made to you as a writer to have this position at a university?
Richard, I think I made a decision very early in my life, which had to do with the fact that I thought I would never earn a living as a writer. Hmm. At least I'd never have to. And I thought back then, half a century ago, more than half a century ago, that would free me to write anything I wanted to write. Hmm. I had friends who were writers. I had gone to the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, surrounded by writers, preceded by writers. And
you did a PhD at Iowa.
I did a PhD. At that time, the University of Iowa was the only place in the United States where one could get a PhD as a writer. That is, one could write, instead of a critical or historical dissertation, a book of stories, which is what I did, a novel, or in the case of Tennessee Williams, who wrote an early version of The Glass Menagerie, a play. Flannery O'Connor did not get a PhD, but she had preceded me as a graduate student and written stories.
And your plan all along was to get a job at a university?
That's right. The idea was that I would make a living as a university teacher, and anything that came in by way of writing was gravy. There has not been much gravy. so I correctly predicted the occurrence. I mean, later on, I began to think about the whole matter of being associated with a university. I was conscious that in the days of Shakespeare, many writers were associated with the stage. A few years later, in the time of Donne and Herrick and so on, they were preachers. In the days of Pope, people were associated with the new publishing industry. So I realized there was usually a dominant profession. Although in the early Romantic period, because of Byron and Shelley and people like that, you had the impression that writers were freed of professional entanglement and could do whatever they wanted.
It's nice to be rich.
It's nice to be rich. But at any rate, this created the rhythm of my life. And thanks to my boss here, because I was hired by the English department, headed then by Walter Blair, and by the Committee on General Studies and Humanities, which had been founded by and was presided over by Norman MacLean. I was hired by that as its first employer. I hadn't realized that Norman then had a personal investment in writing. But I saw that he took care of me. He went over to the department and worked out with Blair that I would have my time on the whole in the mornings to write. And that I would do my teaching in the afternoon.
Do you think your fiction or work would be any different outside of a university if you had some other job that you did in the afternoon?
Yes. I know that in the course of my writing life, the few jobs that I'd held as at Paramount Pictures, at a department store in Evansville, Indiana, at a radio station in Florida.
I can't see you in a department store, Dick. What department were you in?
Well, I
was selling shoes.
After I was hired by the Consolidated Retail Stores. I've written a little bit about my interview in the Garment District in New York with two cigar-smoking, beefy gentlemen who, thanks to my Uncle Bert, decided to take a chance in my Chapel Hill, BA, and ship me off to Evansville, Indiana. I, who had never been west of Pennsylvania, Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And it was a kind of six-week death trip for me. And yet, looking back,
you weren't cut out for retail, you don't think?
I moved from one department to the other. I packed up goods. I worked in advertising. I walked the floors and was told by the great chief of the Consolidated Retail Stores, it was a little fluffy-haired homunculus who came up to me and took my yellow sleeveless sweater, which my sister had knit for me for Christmas, and said, "Don't wear that again on the floor, Sonny." And at any rate, I did all these things and learned a great deal, and then was summoned by my then girlfriend to Orlando, Florida, and got a job in the radio station down there. But as I say, yes, because I've drawn on those experiences. Mm-hmm. I've drawn on Evansville. Mm-hmm. I remember the streets there. I went through about a dozen years ago, and I saw the street on Walnut Street, and my landlady, this immense woman who every inch of whose body had been operated on and charted, and her husband who had fled from Chicago. He'd owned a bar, and I thought of Hemingway's The Killers. No, absolutely, my work would have been different. But as I wrote in a kind of essay once, Borges's work would have been different. Mm-hmm. Bellow's work, all these people associated with universities, the quality of the fiction, the level at which one aimed, the intellectual content that one could write about the sufferings and glories and so on of people in our line of work.
It's wonderful just hearing you talk about these odd jobs you had. You can tell this person is a novelist. I mean, just you remember the fat lady and her operations and her husband and what her husband used to do. There's a kind of absorptiveness to your sensibility for details about people's lives that I think is sort of the things that I treasure knowing you. It just and it seems to me it's got to be such a big part of being a novelist, is that these small details about people seem so rich. And you might forget everything about what they said, but you remember how they looked, some detail which stays with you and which might turn up in a book or a story, that somehow it's there.
Well, I wonder if this was always there. I mean, because I remember doing my first writing when I was 12. I had a wonderful high school teacher at Stuyvesant, Mr. Lowenthal.
You were 12? You were in high school when you were 12?
Well, no. Because in those days, in the Depression days, they tried to free up funds and they used to skip people.
Uh-huh.
So I entered Stuyvesant at 12.
Really?
And I had Mr. Lowenthal, maybe in the next year when I was 13, wonderful fellow in a blue pinstripe suit with a great nose, very serious, gloomy. But he had people write stories if they wanted to.
So you've already made a character of him.
Well, I owe this man a great deal. And I read this derivative story and the class laughed. You know, the usual business.
Now, were they supposed to laugh or not?
I hope so. I don't know. I can remember the story because it derived from some other story that I'd read. Naturally, like most people, I'd been a great reader. You too. Read early and as much as you can. At any rate, so I've thought of myself as a writer ever since, but I really haven't thought much about what you had just pointed out, that this...
I just think this cherishing of detail I think there are people who remember, striking things somebody said. Mm-hmm. or remember, you know, political events, but I think just the way in which details are sort of vivid in your mind from, you know, 60 years ago as if they were yesterday. I think there's something special about that, and something that seems to me, as a non-novelist, very novelistic. Seems very, well, very probably productive of fiction. Because after fiction, at least reasonably traditional fiction, has to be grounded in a world of physical being and physical objects and faces and bodies. Mm. And it's not just, unless you're doing sort of some kind of stream of consciousness thing, it's not just thoughts, not just minds. Mm. You need bodies and colors and rooms for people to sit in.
I wonder if you can make a distinction in the memory bins of novelists, well, writers like, say, Beckett on the one hand, mm-hmm. and realist, more or less realistic mm-hmm. writers on the other. Mm-hmm. As if, perhaps someone like Beckett's concentration is on something different. What do you think?
I bet that's right. I mean, I think Beckett could probably not tell you what room he and Joyce were sitting in at any given moment, but he could probably recall the conversation in tremendous detail.
What he could do, and I remember this distinctly, because on our very first meeting in Paris over beer, which he spilled and apologized for, later on he had a cataract operation. So, but at any rate, that first meeting, he imitated Joyce when he read that marvelous poem about Joyce of the gas burner. And it was a thrilling moment. He had a wonderful ear. Mm. He was very sensitive to accents. And so when they finally staged his plays in Ireland, he was extremely happy. He says, yes, that's the way
sounded. That's the way he heard it.
And of course, he couldn't have become the master of French that he became unless he was sensitive to sounds, music, voices. Mm-hmm. And perhaps he was closer to a musician in his forms of memory. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
I bet he wouldn't remember that he spilled the beer and that it was before he had the cataract operation. I mean, just these details that you just spill out of you, that are just part of your sense of, again, that people are in a world. You know,
my palate.
Yeah, that people live in a physical world where there are such things as beer glasses and operations, whereas I suspect that Beckett might remember what you talked about, or might remember some idea that you had or some question you asked, but would completely forget the context. Whereas I could rely on you to tell me what the weather was, what it was like walking to the bar where you met him.
I think you're right, Richard, and I wonder if it relates to my nervousness about ideology, about strong commitment to very large interpretation of, say, the universe.
Very interesting.
I'm even though I have a disposition to a craving for understanding the nature of things, I can't remember a time, well, except in adolescence, I can't remember a time in the last, say, 50 years in which the formulation of a religious view has not seemed to me almost, if I could say this, sacrilegious, that there is that I have retreated from the attempts of human beings to make sense of what seems to me is beyond the capacity of humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Though one of your favorite poets on whom you've written so wonderfully, George Herbert, is someone who attracted me in his emotional response to the religious situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Flannery O'Connor, in her most theological letters, has gripped me. Mm-hmm. And the Bellow, who wrote in Humboldt's Gift about religious matters. Those, for some reason, have moved me almost to the point of commitment. But generally speaking, I may be mired, to use a pejorative word, in what you've pointed out as the details.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a lot here. I mean, on the religious side, I mean, the people you've mentioned are all people, even though they're very deeply committed to, with the exception of Bello, to a theology. What you get in O'Connor and in Herbert is the lived experience of that
yes.
theology. You don't just get abstract statements of document, but of doctrine, but you get what it feels like to believe
Perfect.
This or that, and
right.
what it's like for a human being to inhabit a world where these things are taken to be truths, and it's very much within a world and within an individual psyche. No, I remember. I just as you were talking, I was thinking about this wonderful line in Wallace Stevens. I think it's in one of his adagia, where he says, "The greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world." And I think that it just it's part of the richness of the whole realistic tradition in fiction to be insistent on. The physical world, the social world, that whatever else is going on, we're here in our bodies, mm-hmm. in a place, mm-hmm. And that all that matters. And I think mm-hmm. that, I think you're right. I think the sort of, there's a kind of inherent, not debunking quality, it could be a celebratory quality, but a kind of anti-ideological quality to it, which is a refusal to leave the immediate world of the physical mm-hmm. and the social. And there's something, I think there's something very honorable about that.
Well, yes, that strikes the right note for me.
It's not mired, it can have right. a celebratory.
Well, I mean, you can move from the lacrimae rerum, the tears of things, the passion in things, to it is the thing itself which has meaning. All the imagists talking about that. Bello has that, too, by the way. He mm. is, and his theology is almost a theology of matter.
Mm.
But, in my view, but yes, if I had to formulate it, I would say everything, every situation is itself so complex, so rich, that any formulation about it is mm. dangerous, a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
That's the meaning of my title in any case,
mm.
Which is a sort of a spy story on the surface. But it's the Hamletic inability to fix the actualities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, earlier we were talking about Emma, which I've just reread because, as you know, I have to lecture on it and many other things that I haven't read in many years. This coming January in India. And I was saying that what struck me so was that here Jane Austen takes a very small group of people
mm-hmm.
who have lived with each other their whole lives,
mm-hmm.
who have the leisure, who have a passion, the specialty, the almost professional interest in studying each other, observing each other's behavior, analyzing each other's motives and character. And yet, these people almost always make crucial right. mistakes about each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I suppose you could say that's a testament to the complexity mm-hmm, of the mm-hmm. of the human situation, which is deals with flesh and blood and life. And
well,
and
you could take it even further. I mean, Emma's great mistake is presuming that she knows things.
Exactly.
Presuming that she understands and that she can therefore intervene because
exactly.
she understands so well.
And becomes detestable.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, this charming 21-year-old girl you hate as you see her trying on the basis of inadequate interpretation
mm-hmm.
To twist the life of little Harriet Smith.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a marvelous, marvelous insight into this extraordinary writer who was much more open to the world and to herself, and I
mm-hmm.
think reveals far more than is generally thought. I'm not a specialist.
I mean, you might say that, you know, one of the morals of that book, so to speak, is don't intervene, even if you think you know what's going on, is just just allow things to happen. And I wonder if as a novelist, you've got to feel something like that, that some part of you, even while you're engaged in your daily, is sort of watching, trying not to, just to try to sort of take it in and sort of allow it to take its course. I mean, it sounds a little fatalistic, but there's got to be some part of you which is always observing, always imagining, writing this scene as it's happening.
Yes, I think that's a crucial element and a crucial part of the fun, the amusement in putting the words into the mouth of somebody who does not speak as you do or as anybody else in the book. It's a delightful, it's a pleasure in writing. And, you know, people say the characters took over. To some degree, that is certainly right, or at least the action of the book becomes more and more itself. People like me who write draft after draft after draft see the shedding of all sorts of preconceptions and the dedication, the attempt to find out what is sometimes the heart of the onion, therefore it's not there. But really, what is the essential story? What is one after? Some people know very early, and at times in one's own work, there has been an arc which you can plot. You know what's going to happen at the end. Mm-hmm. But the pleasure of discovery en route is so rich as one thinks day after day of how to make an interesting page, an interesting paragraph. Mm-hmm. Whereas for Poe, who detested this sort of thing, who wanted the lyric poem to be contained and done something off the spur of the moment, a kernel of purity that would embody this initial impulse to write, that's alien, I think, to people who write day after day after day. Mm-hmm. Even a kind of novelistic machine like Miss Oates clearly loses herself, probably in a trance-like way, in the pressure of invention day after day with the character in whom she's immersed herself, or in the fiction which she's immersed herself. But yes, this release of oneself, which approaches, I suppose, a Keatsian negative capability, namely the ability to suspend, the ability to write about someone whom you'd against whom you'd had strong feelings, for whom you'd had strong negative feelings,
well, this is,
and then turn that around.
Well, this is where I wanted to go. I mean, thinking about sort of where novels start, I mean, this is something obviously people are always very interested in, is sort of the creative process, and because a lot of people fantasize about writing novels or poems or plays, but most people either never do it or stop doing it at a very early age. But someone like yourself spent a whole career doing it. It's had the experience of, you know, written, 12 novels?
11
novels. So this is you've had much experience with this. Where does it start with? Does it start with a character, a situation, a plot, an outcome? Does it start with a phrase that sticks in your mind? Where do you think?
Well, as
talk about the genesis of one of
as you probably suspect, there are very different ways which they start. My first published book, Galk, started with a joy in what became a famous national program, the Candid Camera Show, but which I'd heard as Candid Microphone originally. And the brilliance of evoking from the ordinary man in the street some farcical or tragic revelation was marvelous for me. It was, and at a certain point, I saw that must be a book, and I remember strategically picking up, in this case, from the beginning of Anna Karenina with Stefan Verhovensky, From the Sun Also Rises, which doesn't begin with Jake Bonds, but Robert Cohn, and Madame Bovary, which doesn't begin with Madame Bovary, but Charles, approach the source of power indirectly with another character. Mm. So I invented what became the most interesting character in a way, Hondorp, the man who is gawked, who is found in the fish store, in the bookstore, is assailed and reveals himself and joins up. So that was that book.
The strategy was what intrigued you.
I had the impulse from this wonderful creator, this odd creator, Galk. But then to work the book out, the strategy came in. And each of the books, I think, has involved something like that. One that I'd started before that, Europe, dealt with three major characters, and I followed each of them. But I didn't know how to do it until my friend Mike Swearin, who'd been a musician, a trombonist, and who has, for the last 40 years, written jazz for the International Herald Tribune, and whose writing I worked on at the beginning as he made the transition from jazz to writing, he said, "Why don't you use numbers and break it up in parts?" I mean, the simplest sort of thing in the world. What a relief. I didn't have to beat everything to death. I could stop the scenes when I wanted and shift. And so on. In any case, and I'll stop after this one, that came from reading a remarkable book about World War II. An English spinster had a dear friend, an Indian girl in London, who disappeared. She tried to find out what had happened to this girl, found out that she had been connected with a very odd group of English agents, Special Operation Executive, it was called, and had been killed when a member of the group had turned on the group, given it over to the Germans, had blown it, and they were killed.
Now, this is a true story?
This is a true story, and at the end of the book, the English spinster said, was about to go visit this traitor, confront him. For me, that was the beginning of the book. And I thought the whole book is about treason, the meaning of treason. What does betrayal mean? And the leading character feels himself. He's the father of one of the agents who gets killed. So that, as I say, came from out there, this book, but it seized on something very deep in myself at that time. So at any rate, as you see, three different books, three different origins, and each book, I think, has involved that. And no book has come easy. And no, the crucial question is, when do you know that a situation is a story, when a novel? That's an interesting point. Or when do you cut a novel down to a novella or a story?
Okay, you've asked the question. What's the answer?
Well, there must be a kind of...
This is what you get from years of teaching by the discussion method. Student asks a question, you just turn it back to them.
Well, sometimes, of course, you see the photograph. It's a photograph, and you just want to get it down. But at other times you feel, let's say you're doing a character, you're interested in a character, maybe related to an actual one, maybe not, but perhaps fueled by a feeling of affection or disaffection, you set down this character, bringing in whatever you want. But then you feel the character connecting to other people. And what has been just sketched like gets you involved in the relationship of these forces, the two characters. And then sometimes even there's a parallel situation. Another character comes in and takes interest. And the development of the parallels becomes itself a wonderfully rich opportunity. And you know you're then into something.
So would you say that it's the presence of more than one story at the same time that gives you the feeling that this might be a novel?
often that's it. And you know, dealing with double plots in Shakespeare, Gloucester and Lear and so on, the universalization of a phenomenon is what that does. I mean, it's a tremendously powerful and difficult thing to do. So that in the novel is certainly always there. And I've never written a real, I mean, a War and Peace, a Middlemarch, I mean, something
a
big.
A huge novel.
Yeah. And so, in fact, that's almost not done now, though I admire Richard Rousseau, particularly, not so much Empire Falls, though that's good, but the book called Nobody's Fool, in which he conjures up a whole town. Jonathan Franzen in The Corrections has done a fairly large novel working from a family. Generally speaking, the novelists of our time have avoided that, or if they have not avoided it, they trip. And I mean, Pynchon has done the enormous thematic, farcical, semi-farcical involvements with using history and other things to swell his book. But at any rate, yes, the spy book, for instance, I got involved with the father, and then the son's girlfriend, and then the father's entanglement with the son's girlfriend, and the father's entanglement with the spy. I mean, the things just sort of fell into my lap. Not as if the falling was easy, because the writing was excruciating.
Well, we should probably draw toward a close here, but I want to ask you one other question. One thing that I've always admired in your writing is the writing, is the sentences. I mean, you're someone in whose sentences one can take pleasure. Do you feel that your style is continuous from novel to novel, or do you feel that it changes at all? Maybe this is too large to end on, but
well,
say a few words on this, and then we're...
I have thought about this, because about 20 years ago, cleaning out a closet, I discovered a paper I'd written for Dr. Helmut Kuhn at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, 2 pages on Aristotle. And I said, my God, that's the way I write now. And I then looked into myself and realized that I had a detestation for the swollen, the flamboyant, the excessive. I mean, it hit me. Most of my life's work has been editing my students and telling them, omit, 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 boil down. And I one time analyzed it in terms of my mother's almost pathological hatred of dirt, excess. I can see her cleaning up the ashes or the table. Everything had to be clean. And I think that communicated itself to me. I once called it, to my father's anger, her anality. But I must have the literary equivalent of it. Even though I adore Bellow's rich work, Proust is my idol, still, Shakespeare, my God, is God. But for myself, there is this fierce, tigrish detestation of excess.
Well,
so,
maybe we should end on the line, his true Penelope was Flaubert.
Good place to
end.
Well,
anyhow, this was a great conversation, and we'll continue it forever.
Right, Richard, it's such a joy having you to talk with.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.